May it please the court, I am Randall Kelly. My registration number is 13757. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Curtis Webster. Only appeal issue is the interpretation of the statutory employer section of the Colorado Workers' Compensation Act. And specifically on division of that act that confers a partial tort immunity when there is no policy in place for a subcontractor or, in my client's case, a working general partner who has opted not to give coverage. In interpreting what the statute is supposed to mean, I think there's three subjects. The cases tell us there's three subjects that we should look at. The declaration of the purpose of the statute. All the cases, all the way through Pulsifer, have told us what the purpose of the statute was. It applies to subcontractors who fail to protect themselves when the act does not protect them through a general contractor's policy. That's straight out of Pulsifer at page 663. The next subject is the title of the act. The very title, part four, is contractors and lessees. It goes on to define statutory employment. It goes on to define the rights and obligations of the statutory employer. The third subject is the legislative history. There's a lot of comment, specific comment about the legislative history.
Is this provision of the statute, in your view, ambiguous?
Your Honor, I think it has been interpreted in two different ways, and so therefore I think it's subject to different interpretations.
And what are those?
Well, in the opinion that I believe Your Honor wrote in Cavallari versus Anderson, it's been extended out to apply irrespective of the status of the employer. And I think Pulsifer and all cases that go all the way back in time say just the opposite. So I think there is an inconsistency. The case that I relied upon is the one cited by the appellee about looking into the legislative history. It is the CLPF Parkridge 1LP case. It says statutory provisions are unclear, ambiguous, or susceptible to different interpretations. And I think we've got a really important question.
So you're saying there's a conflict in the case law?
I think Cavallari is something that goes completely off on a tangent from every other case before it.
I've been wrong before.
Sir, I have too. When I saw that you were going to be on this panel, I thought, well, I'm going to have to just say.
Well, I want you to know it's not by design. It's random.
Well, and I didn't think it was by design. But I have a lot of respect for you, Aaron, obviously. I don't think you got it right in Cavallari. I think the legislative history really tells us the true story of what this was meant to do. I call it the Oliver Amendment because...
Mr. Kelly, sorry, go ahead and finish your answer, but in part of your answer, could you elaborate along the way exactly how you think Cavallari differs from Pulsifer?
The main departure is Pulsifer is a statutory employer case. This statute, in this particular partial tort immunity at section 4013, has never been interpreted outside the context of statutory employment until the Cavallari case. Cavallari is a departure for that reason. In every single one of those cases, Pulsifer, all the way back down, 50 years of jurisprudence, the issue was the status of the employer. If you qualify as a statutory employer, you have an obligation to purchase a policy. And after the Oliver Amendment came into place, the subcontractor who failed to get his own coverage could no longer attach to that policy. In addition, the General Assembly said, we want that claim, if it's a tort claim between the subcontractor and the general, to be something that the subcontractor is allowed to do, and we're going to limit the tort damages as to that claim. In Pulsifer, for example, and I'll get to Cavallari in a minute, Pulsifer was free to sue in tort anybody else at that construction site, unlimited. The only limitation was as to the claim against his general contractor, and only because the general contractor complied with his obligation as a statutory employer to buy coverage. When we get to Cavallari versus Anderson, we've got somebody who's specifically excluded from the operation of the act as a matter of law. Couldn't probably buy coverage if he wanted to.
Well, Mr. Kelly, in Pulsifer was the question whether it was a statutory employer or not and whether the person then qualified for the damages. on that reason, or did it happen to be that was the issue?
The issue in Pulsifer, I frankly can't believe that the argument was made. The subcontractor tried to argue that he was someone not in the same employ, which is the final exceptionary language under 4013. Well, he knows that he's a subcontractor hired by a general. You just read the first part of the statutory employer section, and he clearly is a constructive employee. There's only two types of employment under the Act. You either employ somebody in your trade or business, or if you're in the business of hiring people to do a job like a general, then you're construed to be an employer. Those are the only two situations where employment status attaches. It's critically important because it defines who's required to buy the policy. If we get back to Cavallari versus Anderson, no one is required to buy a policy. Webster's lawfully excluded from having to purchase workers' compensation coverage. Grimwood, under the Act specifically does not apply to him. So we then have no policy in place from which Grimwood would, or excuse me, Webster would have otherwise been entitled to coverage. And I think that's really the key sentence, the one that maybe has been susceptible to different interpretations under the 4013 Oliver Amendment, as I call it.
It under, says, sorry, Mr. Kelly, under that, under the statute of the 4013, couldn't Mr. Webster have purchased workers' comp insurance or participated in the system if he wished to?
Well, the statutory employer statute has nothing to do with whether Webster could participate. Yes, he could buy coverage. I mean, I can buy coverage as a lawyer. Anybody can buy workers' compensation coverage if they have employees. And if I believe you have a construction business, you certainly can buy it. I think I could buy it for myself, but I happen to have an employee. It doesn't have anything to do with the statutory employer section.
I think you have to elect whether you're going to cover yourself or not.
Well,
and I think when I was in practice, I elected not to cover myself, only my employees.
I elect not to cover myself, too. I've been around workers' compensation law enough to know I don't want to be a part of that system. I've got a good health insurance policy, but my employee's covered. Kelly versus Mile High Single Ply. It's the corporate officer situation where the corporate officer can elect not to have the coverage. And for the same reasons, I mean, they can provide for their medical expenses or their disability through some other insurance policy.
Under Pulsifer, isn't this statute designed to apply to those people who could have obtained workers' comp coverage but chose not to? And it applies to the kinds of cause of action they can bring and the limits on those cause of actions. Isn't that your client?
My client is not in Pulsifer. Pulsifer involved a claim by a subcontractor against a statutory employer, general contractor. It is the precise thing that the Oliver Amendment was intended to address. Because in Oliver, the subcontractor didn't buy the coverage, but then he latched on to the general's policy. And the General Assembly wanted to stop that practice. And in doing so, they modified the statutory employer provision in 4013 to say that you no longer can attach to someone else's policy. If you don't buy, you don't get any workers' comp. And secondly, the second purpose was to say now we've lifted the immunity, the tort immunity that would have otherwise been there for the statutory employer, so we're going to impose partial immunity. And in doing so, they recognized that they had to have at least some claim available, or else it wouldn't be constitutional. You have to give something in return for the immunity. That's how the Comp Act works. So yes, he could have impulsively purchased and chose not to, and then he brought a tort claim against his general contractor, and he was limited to $15,000. That's exactly what the statute was intended to accomplish.
So if we agree that's what the statute intended to accomplish, where is there a limit in the statutory language that says it is only if an action is brought against a general contractor?
There is no sentence that says that, but the title under which this provision is in statutory employment. The Workers' Compensation Act is a big statute, and if you read it as a whole, it's not meant to cover every employment situation. It wasn't meant to cover this employment situation. It's not meant to cover when someone hires me to be their lawyer, or I go hire somebody else to cut my hair, or to clean my house. There are a number of situations that are not intended to apply under workers' compensation law. They just aren't. But in this specific context of statutory employment, there was a wrong that the General Assembly sought to correct, and it applied to subcontractors' claims against generals. If you look at the history of workers' compensation jurisprudence, a third party is someone who is not an employer or a statutory employer. Everybody else is a third party. The only ones that have immunity are the ones that provide the coverage. You must buy a policy to get the immunity. That is the history of our act. It is the quid pro quo for substituting a statutory remedy for a common law. It's what it's all about. And if we take the Cavallari, or now the Webster versus Grimwood case, Grimwood gives nothing for almost $1.5 million worth of immunity with a liability insurance policy in that amount. He gave nothing for it. I don't understand, I really don't, read all of these cases and all of this law, how that part could escape the analysis. You can't get immunity unless you give something in return. Under 4013, the general contractor is in compliance with his 4011 obligation. He's purchased that policy. He's done what he's supposed to do to get his immunity. And even though the subcontractor can no longer get the no-fault remedy, the penalty against his general is that he can't sue him in tort for more than $15,000 damages. But it doesn't apply this way.
Now explain to me why I was wrong in Grimwood.
I think you, in Cavallari?
Cavallari, I'm sorry.
Your Honor, I think you were wrong this way. I think you were wrong by latching on to a sentence in the Pulsifer decision that said whether he was an employee or even an employer doesn't matter. And you said, so I'm going to conclude that the status of the tortfeasor doesn't matter. Because Cavallari is very similar. It's a homeowner. I think it was a Tyler, and then the Tyler, when he was leaving the job, slipped and fell. I can't remember the exact time, but it's something like that. He said the status of the tortfeasor doesn't matter. The key thing to focus on is that the subcontractor could have purchased coverage and didn't. And so therefore, the $15,000 damage limit applies. And I think the error in that analysis, with all due respect, is that the whole statute has to be read. There was no policy in place. And if you read the statutory language, it clearly says a work-related injury that would have otherwise been compensable under the Act. That presumes the existence of a policy. And so I think that's where it went off the rail. I also think that Pulsifer could have been a little clearer. But Pulsifer clearly does talk about the fact that they are interpreting what otherwise not in the same employee means in the context of a subcontractor bringing a tort claim against his general contractor. And if we look backward from Pulsifer, I think Smith might have been after Pulsifer's Court of Appeals case on the constitutional challenge. It's replete with this is intended to apply to this employment relationship. And that relationship has to focus on the status of the employer. Is it an employer within the meaning of the Act? Yes, it is. It's a constructive statutory employer.
So the only way the homeowner gets the benefit of the immunity of not having being excused from buying the policy is to in fact buy the policy?
I don't think a homeowner could even buy a workers' compensation policy. They don't employ that person. They have liability insurance.
Well, what is the relationship between the parties here?
It's the same relationship as the parties in Cavallari versus Anderson. There's a contract entered into to build a deck on a residential house. It's the same relationship. It was bid. They had a contract price. I suppose they could have included, if the parties would have wanted to, let's have workers' compensation build it into the price. That wasn't part of the discussion. Webster had liability insurance, Grimwood had liability insurance. They were insuring against their tort liability. They chose not to insure against their workers' compensation, and this isn't part of the record, but I don't even think Grimwood could have bought a workers' compensation policy. He didn't have employees. The employer that can buy the policy is someone who employs another in his trade or business. You know, having someone come to build a deck on your house isn't your trade or business. It's never been a relationship ever that's been governed under workers' compensation law. No obligation.
So the relationship between these parties are independent contractor relationship?
Yeah, I mean, it's Webster had a partner and they had a construction business that started. They had an ad in the newspaper. Greenwood called when he was getting bids in the deck and he liked them and he liked their bids, so he said, yep, I agree to your contract, they signed it up, and the deck starts being built. That's the relationship. It's not an employment situation within the meaning of the Workers' Compensation Act. And the other thing, the Act, in the statutory employer section under 4021, says that it shall not apply to homeowners. This Act shall not apply to homeowners. I don't know how anybody could buy coverage when the Act says it may not, shall not apply to them.
But Webster could have bought coverage for himself?
Of course he could. Okay. I believe, when I say of course, I believe he could.
Okay.
Typically, I think you need to have an employee. They didn't have employees, but I believe he could have purchased coverage. That was something that I never did. That is not part of the record in this case, I'll put it that way. And okay. I'm not that attuned to workers' compensation purchases.
Okay, so assuming if he could have bought coverage for himself, so looking at the language of 1841.401.3, when it discusses a work-related injury that otherwise would have otherwise been compensable, had Webster chosen to get workers' comp policy, it would have otherwise been compensable, so why would the statute not apply?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and that was something that I struggled with for a long time. 4013 is defining what precedes it. In other words, the obligation of the general contractor, statutory employer, to buy coverage. All right. The beginning of 4013 starts to talk about, if you haven't bought your own policy, then you don't get to ask for coverage under the general contractor's policy. And I believe that the language has to relate to that. If you look at the legislative intent, behind all the House and Senate hearings, they were very clear they did not want this to apply outside the context of statutory employment. They were very concerned that it would apply to what were referred to as third-party claims, meaning any claims that did not involve an employer-employee relationship within the meaning of the Act or a statutory employer relationship. So I believe that the rational interpretation is that a work-related injury that would have otherwise been compensable means that would have otherwise been compensable before all, or you could have gone upstream to the general contractor's policy. It's the Oliver Amendment. That's the problem that they were trying to address. You may no longer go upstream. Now, if the general contractor doesn't buy the policy, well, under the Comp Act, he's unlimited tort claims. He has to have his policy in place, and that's the one that is in place under the statutory employment section.
Well, as a homeowner who's hired people to come and work from time to time, I've always concluded that I have no liability for their injuries. You're telling me I do.
I think we're mixing apples and oranges. I don't think you have a no-fault liability, but I think it's always possible that you'd have a tort liability for negligence. If, for example, I hate slip and fall cases as an example, but let's say that you had a broken pipe and it was winter and you knew it and there was a big ice thing there and you didn't tell the person that slipped and fell.
I'd be liable for premises liability. Premises liability, which affords the homeowner, even in a business and by deed, some protection.
Yes, and that's exactly what went on in Cavallari versus Anderson. I mean, in Cavallari, they didn't even get to the damage trial that we had here. The insurance companies have the liability companies have a new plan. It's called tender. So they just come in and they write a check for $15,000 and deposit it in the court and say, case over. That's the same thing that was attempted in this case. Case over. Here's $15,000. It's a liability risk. It's not a workman's compensation risk.
Well, there's a lot of discussion that the purpose of this section is to encourage people, such as your client, to buy workman's compensation coverage.
Yes.
You would agree with that?
Yes, sir.
And the penalty for their not doing so is that they're limited to $15,000.
Well, that would be one way to describe it, but the immunity that's given to the general contractor is a ceiling of $15,000 because it is an immunity provision. It is immunity under the Act. And to switch the focus back onto the penalty, I mean, it is a penalty, let's face it, in this case, it's an enormous penalty. This man's disabled for the rest of his life. A conservative jury in Southwest Colorado said it was $3 million damage care claim. You couldn't have a bigger penalty. But I think that if you look at the legislative hearings, it's very clear. It's a twofold purpose. Once they pulled out the right of the subcontractor to latch on to the general policy, they removed the regular tort immunity that would apply. And so they needed to fill that void. And the Kelly versus Mile High Single Ply case talks about that. So it's an immunity provision. It ends up being a penalty, but if you look at the legislative hearings, they call it encouragement. We want to encourage them. We've created this system, I think the exact language is we've created this system and we want to encourage people to participate in it. But it's twofold, to separate out the penalty or the immunity from what the Oliver Amendment was intended to accomplish is to only apply half of it. And that's how we can get astray and start taking it out into third-party situations that aren't supposed to be governed by the Act, ever, as to tort claims. Webster could have never claimed that Grimwood had to give him workers' compensation coverage, even if he had a policy. He's not his employee. This is a tort claim. Historically, the Act encourages tort claims, especially because we can claw back money and refund the system because of the statutory lien. But it's always encouraged tort claims, recognizing the constitutional component, the quid pro quo component of workman's compensation jurisprudence, which is you got to give something to get something.
So the fact that Mr. Grimwood was, for lack of a better term, affirmatively negligent in the operation of his equipment, that doesn't make any difference. It could have been a slip and fall on ice on the property. Simple premises liability claim.
It
could have brought it, not be limited.
I think any tort claim. I mean, Cavalier versus Anderson, I believe, is a slip and fall. This happens to be being crushed in front of a motor truck. With court permission, I would like to reserve a little time. And I thank you so much for listening to my arguments.
May it please the court, my name is Benjamin Wagoner, attorney registration number 36952, and myself along with Mr. Davlin represent Justin Grimwood in this matter. I'd like to start off by addressing some of the arguments that Mr. Kelly raised. He said something to the effect of that in Cavalieri we looked at whether or not the focus was whether or not that the injured contractor in that case could obtain coverage. And that this, and he indicated that the status of the homeowner doesn't matter, but actually the status does somewhat matter because the language of the statute talks about somebody in the same employ. And from the Pulsifer case, you're looking at the principal parties to a contract. And in this case, that would be Mr. Grimwood and Mr. Webster. Mr. Grimwood hired Mr. Webster to come and build a deck on his property. That satisfies this relationship part of the statute. And that's important because what it deals with is work-related injuries. This isn't any type of tortfeasor type of case. This isn't a case, as Mr. Kelly said, where somebody would go in and get their hair cut and this would apply. Or he raised in his brief a few times about a car accident or a law professor injured by a student. Those aren't compensable, or at least wouldn't be subject to the statute because those injuries are going to be caused by someone not in the same employ. So the status of Mr. Grimwood is important for this case. And the reason that's important, as Mr. Kelly pointed out, is that there needs to be a policy in place where Webster might have coverage for a work-related injury. And that's through the Workman's Compensation Act. The key to this is that he was a working general partner of his business. The key is working. He was out there every day picking up the hammer.
Was this an LLC or a corporation or?
It was an LLP. It's Mr. It's a partnership. He was a working general partner of that partnership. He was out there every day hammering and putting up boards, unloading trailers, doing those kind of things. He knew the risks involved with his job. The key to that is working. He's out there every day. And he is bidding out a job for Mr. Grimler, to build a deck. As part of that, he's the best person, Mr. Webster is the best person to determine what kind of risks am I associating with this job, what kind of compensation am I going to seek for this job. As part of that, he could have built in his overhead, such as getting a commercial general liability policy, getting a workman's comp policy for himself on the price of that bid. So there's a mechanism for him to do that. And by electing to exclude himself from coverage under his system, he pulled himself out of there, and he subject himself to the cap, whether he knew it or not. That's what he did, and frankly, Mr. Kelly talked about the legislative history of this and how it applies to contractors, or how they talked about it with contractors. That's also an important thing to say, is that it just so happened that the case that they're trying to alleviate from involved the contractor and the subcontractor. Because that type of work is risky, and it often has injuries. But the case law or the statute doesn't specifically define or limit it to contractors or statutory employer general contractors. The statute says what it says, and it doesn't say that it's limited to that. What it does say is that if it's work-related injury, otherwise compensable from someone not in the same employ, this could apply to all sorts of different people besides contractors. I have a law firm, I have an IT person who comes in that has his own business. He could get hurt doing that job, and he would be limited to the 15 if he chose not to work for a comp. It also applies in situations with oil and gas companies. Hire a company man to go out and supervise, and that's a consultant who might elect coverage not to have work comp for himself, and he's injured. Would he be subject to that cap potentially? In this case, so it applies beyond contractors, which is what the Cavallari decision said, which was also based on the Pulsifer decision, I believe, in terms of looking at the language of who is your employee and it's the principal parties.
But under the normal structure of the Workman's Comp Act, if there's a general contractor and a subcontractor, and a subcontractor does not insure, then the employee of the subcontractor who is hurt may sue, or may get workman's comp, at least, from the general.
He may. I think there's situations where he may not. If there's a contractual provisions where the sub was going to agree to pay for the work comp or get it himself, provide a certificate of insurances, I think there's situations in which the general may not. He might be deemed a statutory employer, but he may not have to provide it in certain circumstances. And that's really the thing of it is you're looking at these parties who are contracting with each other and the risk associated with it. And those parties are the best parties to identify these risks and insure themselves against it, which is the Justin Greenwood and Curtis Webster situation, is that they could have very well dealt with that situation. And Mr. Webster, as a business owner, could have dealt with that by building into his price the coverage of work comp, but he elected not to do that.
Mr. Wagoner, how could Mr. Grimwood have dealt with it, to use your words? If this issue had been raised, what could Mr. Grimwood have done? Could he have provided workers' comp insurance or any other sort of insurance? I'm trying to figure out how this could have been handled differently if the parties had discussed it at the outset of the contract.
Well, Mr. Grimwood could have ensured that I guess could make sure that Mr. Webster had workman's comp insurance if that was a critical factor, or they could have talked about building into a price different payment schedules to allow for that type of insurance to be provided.
And just to help me out, what would be Mr. Grimwood's incentive to do that?
To avoid a lawsuit.
That would be capped at $15,000.
But still to avoid a lawsuit and to avoid the eventual issue that came to this case of a three-week trial in which the jury verdict kind of being what it is reduced to 15 and pending cost motions for hundreds of thousands of dollars. that student's incentive to try to get the student away, or to deal with that on the front end, I should say, is that that's the purpose of CAP, is to say, here's your CAP, and to alleviate the, what eventually happened in this case.
Thank you.
The language of the statute, I believe, is clear, and this case, as Mr. Kelly pointed out, is nearly identical to the Cavallari opinion. You have the same situation with the contractor, the tile setter, and the Cavallari, same thing here. You have a homeowner and a person's coming in to build a deck. And in that case, the cap was upheld, and there's no reason, I believe, to move away from that to a decision in this case.
Do you know if the Supreme Court denied cert or was asked to, whether to grant cert in Cavallari?
It's my understanding that cert was denied in Cavallari. I believe it did. It went up and it was denied.
Thank you.
Mr. Wegener, I'd like you to address the language that work-related injury would otherwise have been compensable, because I understand your opposing counsel is saying, well, it wouldn't otherwise have been compensable because homeowners are excluded from workers' comp.
No. And I think that's where we're maybe disagreeing, because that part of the statute is intended, if you read the Stunt case and the Pulsifer case and kind of go through a little bit of legislative history and things like that with it, and that language of a work-related injury otherwise compensable, had Mr. Webster purchased insurance, a work comp insurance for himself, based on the jury's finding that it was a work-related injury, he would have been able to obtain workman's comp coverage for himself. And that's really what we're talking about, is the whole situation with respect to Oliver and the change in the statute was because they didn't like the idea of these subcontractors not having it, I guess, the best of both worlds, not paying for insurance premiums and then getting hurt and then suing in general when they would otherwise have coverage under their work comp policy. And I think that's what the language of the statute means, is what we're going to do is if you have a work-related injury that's otherwise compensable, i.e. if you had work comp insurance and you tended it over and got coverage, we're not going to let you bring a suit to try to get work comp coverage from somebody else if you don't always have it. I think is the intent and what the legislative history Mr. Kelly pulled up is really talking about and dealing with.
And so your position is that the focus of it was not on the tortfeasor, but the injured person or the sub purchasing?
Right.
Or being able to purchase, but they opted out?
Right, and using this case as an example, so Mr. Webster is hurt and it has a work-related injury, hurt while on the job. And had he had coverage through workman's comp, and had he purchased insurance, he would have coverage for that, they would have paid for it, that injury. But in a situation outside of that, he could have maybe went up the ladder and tried to get work comp through there. So what they did was, with that section, saying, we're not going to allow these people, the sole proprietors, people that don't fall within the definition of employee, a working general partner, or otherwise people who have elected coverage, to go up and try to get work comp from somebody else, having the best of both worlds, not paying for it, but getting it. And then we're also going to limit them if they file suit, because we want to encourage them to obtain work comp. And this case is a perfect example of why we want somebody to encourage to get work comp. Because work comp, at the end of the day, is a no-fault insurance. You have a work-related injury, you know, it could be wholly your fault, could be none of your fault, you're going to get coverage, and you're going to get payment of benefits. The jury in this case found that Mr. Webster was 40% at fault. An additional 10%, we wouldn't even be here today. That was the whole purpose of the reason why they want to encourage people to get work comp. So we don't have to worry about them coming back and trying to argue this, that, and other thing. Instead, they're going to get it, they're going to get it right away. It's going to limit lawsuits. And what we're going to do is cap it. So we encourage these people to go out and get it. And a number of the assertions that have been raised in the briefs from Mr. Kelly talk about the harshness of that cap. Again, these were arguments made in Pulsifer and set out in Pulsifer and decided in Pulsifer. While it is harsh, again, we want people to go out and obtain that insurance because they're the best to insure against that risk, or the best determinant of risk if they elect to make that election not to kill themselves knowingly, and they should bear the burden of that risk. It shouldn't be on a person like a homeowner like Justin Grimwood to bear that risk when Curtis Foster is the best person to do that.
Well, if he'd received workers' compensation under his policy, well, I guess because of the last sentence in this section, I was going to say he could still sue Mr. Grimwood, but the workman's comp carrier would have an interest, but the last sentence of this section talks about accepting the case of action brought against another in the same employee, which is, I gather, means the same employment chain.
Right. I guess I view that as...
So he couldn't bring, if he had workman's comp, he couldn't bring a comp claim.
That's what I believe. I believe there'd be statutory immunity on employment, because I don't think you could, if you get work comp, it's my understanding, I don't do a lot of work comp work, but it's my understanding that you can't, once you get it, the people above the ladder going up the chain are immune to suit. You can sue crossways and down, but never up. It's my understanding how the work comp statute works. And that's the same way here with respect to Mr. Grimwood, is he's the rung above Mr. Webster, and so that's why, since he didn't have work comp coverage, there's no immunity then for Mr. Grimwood, but he's able to file suit against him, but we're going to cap it, because what we really want to do is encourage Mr. Webster to purchase that work comp, so we don't have to worry about this, and particularly any percentage of fault that he might have had, where he's going to get his benefits, and we're not going to file lawsuits, we're not going to go through this unnecessary action of I'm going to do all this and take up all this time for this case. Also, Mr. Kelly talks a lot about statutory history or legislative history. I don't believe that this court has to review that or consider it, mostly because I think the statute is clear on its face and it's not ambiguous at all. It's been applied in this situation like this before. So I think we should continue to apply the holding of Cavallari to this case, which is nearly identical. And moreover, if the statutory or the legislative history is reviewed, there were a couple people that did testify about the idea of, well, you know, if I employ my accountant or my lawyer and they come to my office and are hurt, that this will apply to them. And the answer to that question was, I think, a resounding yes. And the issues with the third parties that they had concerns with, is there anything in the statute that's going to prevent someone, for example, if they're driving to work or on lunch break or some of that nature, running to get something from Home Depot, running there and getting a car accident, would that person who may have hit them in the car going to be subject to this cap and get the benefit of the cap? The answer is no, because again, there's that employment chain isn't there. And so we're really looking at that employment chain. Homeowner, handyman, deck builder. I know Mr. Kelly has raised some constitutional issues. I don't believe those are properly before this court. I have those were raised for the first time after trial. They were never raised before the verdict was entered. I think he's waived those issues, and we shouldn't decide those.
Mr. Wagner, just to clarify, Mr. Webster asked the court to consider his constitutional challenges, but the court never ruled on that request. Is that correct?
He did ask the court to address the constitutionality of it, but that was after judgment had been entered, and the court never did address it. No, the court never issued an order with respect to it. We briefed it, but it was never ruled on.
But the court, correct me if I'm wrong, the court didn't apply the cap until after the judgment or after the verdict from the jury. So isn't that the appropriate time to challenge the cap constitutionally or otherwise?
Well, no, I don't believe so. We raised it in amendment to a pleading as an affirmative defense. We filed a motion, a 56H motion, on whether it applied, and the court ruled on that.
But if your client had achieved a complete victory before the jury, that issue would be moved. Why would the court decide an issue before it's necessary to decide it?
Well, I think the whole reason to raise it before you get to the judgment phase is to know whether or not it does apply. because the good law, the court said it may be unconstitutional. We don't have to worry about it at that point. But we both filed briefs on its applicability. I think he had to preserve that before, because it's a defense he's raised to the applicability of the statute, and he didn't do it until after trial. And had he done it before trial, the court could determine whether or not it applied, then we would also wouldn't be here today otherwise.
Thank you.
But again, with respect to constitutionality issues and arguments, all the issues and arguments that were raised by Mr. Kelly have seemingly been addressed by Snook, and those have passed constitutional muster, and due process is found to be fine. It doesn't seem to violate equal protection or Snook, and I think the same analysis would apply here. I don't think there's any different arguments that have been raised that haven't already been addressed by those courts. And if it's okay with the court, I'd like to move on to our cross appeal, unless there's any other questions. The first issue we raised on our cross appeal was the denial of the 56H motion. Essentially, Justin Grimmett, or what we argued to the court on this motion for determination of law, is that irrespective of the party's version of events and what may happen out there, the statutory language is 841-4013 should apply. And the reason for that is numerous. And I know Mr. Kelly has raised an argument that he believes that this determination is moot on appeal. And I believe there's a couple of reasons why it's not. First, there's an exception to the mootness standard as to whether or not there's some relief that still can be provided. And right, currently pending before our district court in Durango is whether or not one party or other receives costs in this case. I think we both have pending motions for up to around $150,000 each in costs between experts and trial prep and all recoverable type of costs. And if the court addresses this motion and determines that the court erred and should have ruled on it, in favor of us, or in favor of Grimwood, that would affect that prevailing party issue pending right now before the court on district court on costs.
Mr. Wagner, have you found any authority that supports that you can appeal a 56H order after judgment?
Not really. the case law that talks about it talks about if there you can do it if there's some kind of pending if there would be a benefit yet received or there's something that might be addressed by it, as I mentioned, the cost in the lower court. So I think we can bring it, and that's why we did bring it. And also, there's another issue out there, sort of kind of larger in a sense, there's also an exception to the mootness doctrine as something that's before the court, but capable of repetition but evading review. And that's sort of kind of where we're at with a situation like this. There's all sorts of these kind of things that happen every day where someone might get injured, maybe they have work comp, maybe they don't, maybe they bring a suit, maybe they don't. And it would be nice for some determination for us litigants out there who are handling these type of cases to know whether or not if Jesse Grimwood or Curtis Webster's version of the event said he was just doing a favor for Mr. Webster or Mr. Grimwood is something that would be fall under his work-related duties and would be otherwise compensable had he had work comp and subject to the cap. You think about all sorts of situations that might apply. Be going home and have someone who may come in once a month to clean, and they might like go beyond, or you ask them to do something that they normally do and they might get hurt. Does that fall into that category of work-related, unwork-related? And basically the whole situation boils down to, the case law says, is if there's something that's being done that's incidental to the work, whether it's a benefit to the employer, whether it's mutual benefit provided, that it would be a work-related injury and they would otherwise have work comp had they had the coverage.
Mr. Wagner, could you elaborate on your claim that the resolution of the 56H motion would have some effect on whether Mr. Webster was a prevailing party for purposes of costs?
Well, it would have an effect on whether or not Justin Grimwood was a prevailing party. Currently before the court, and another issue I've raised on appeal, is whether or not the $15,000 cap is inclusive of costs as well. And if this court decides it's not,
that affects Mr. Webster's entitlement to costs, right? That's what the cap is reducing, well, not Mr. Grimwood's costs.
Well, not necessarily. We made a statutory offer of settlement, and the decision as to whether or not those potential costs are how it works is that he's got the $15,000 judgment. He can add on his costs to this, and we're looking at whether or not he's going to be the prevailing party or not. And right now, it's close. Has the determination been made that the 56H motion should have been applied? I think that allows Mr. Grimwood to argue that the costs incurred at trial were not necessary and should be considered in the prevailing party determination as to whether the statutory offer beat the underlying judgment, including costs, and that could make a determination.
It only limits costs after the motion is filed, not the pre-motion costs, right?
Right. And frankly, a lot of these costs were incurred, or a good majority of a lot of these costs were incurred because of trial, bringing experts to trial. I mean, both sides had numerous experts coming in. It's a three-week trial. A lot of things were happening back and forth, but it allows that argument to give the trial court some, I hope, some direction as to who may be the prevailing party and entitled to costs because of the statutory offer that was made. And that sort of hops me into my next argument is whether or not the language of 8141.413 is inclusive of costs. That statute talks about the total amount of damages recoverable shall not exceed $15,000. In my briefing, I analogize that to the Governmental Immunity Act, which says the maximum amount that may be recovered is also $350,000. I think the focus is on recovery, what could be recovered. In both, it gives a number, $15,000, $350,000. And there is some case law, I believe, that would support that. We cited the Hall versus American Standard case, which is a recent case that was filed about the new, statutory bad faith statutes, 10.3, 1115, and 1116. And in that, there was discussion as to whether or not the attorney fees and costs would be part of damages. And they talked about whether or not those damages and those attorney fees and those costs are legitimate consequences of the suit that was filed. And in that case, the court said yes, because that was a result of this insurance company's unreasonable or bad faith delay in paying the benefits. Sort of the same could be analogized in this case, because here you have a situation where had Mr. Webster obtained work comp, he would have had a very quick, easy, and fast way to recover his benefits, and he would have got a compensable. He would have been compensated for his injuries. And so what that says is that because of that legislative declaration that we want to encourage people to get work comp, we want to encourage people to maintain work comp, we want to encourage people to use the work comp system, so it's not have to file lawsuits to recover damages that might otherwise be compensable under the work comp act. There would be support that would say that this $15,000 amount would be inclusive of the costs. So any costs, so the $15,000 judgment would be all that's there. The court found it was inclusive of prejudgment interest, and you take it a step further, I think, and say because of legislative history, the legislative intent of the work comp act, and the talk about the total not being able to recover, I think it would also be inclusive of costs as well. And that seemingly is what happened in a number of other cases, although it doesn't really discuss it. A lot of those cases, Pulsifer, Snut, Cavallari, it seems like once the court determined that the cap applied, they were some ways into litigation, and those attorneys then proffered over the $15,000 to the court, and the case was over. So that would be indicative that maybe this cap is really inclusive of costs. The last issue, real quickly, is whether or not the defense should have gotten the 6-9 instruction on the alternate secondary accident. We raised this on a conditional appeal, basically what we've argued is that from the testimony taken at trial, it seems that there is some indication that potentially Mr. Webster, by September of 2010, had, or September 2009, had recovered from his injuries. Dr. Scott, his treating physician, said that his brachial plexus injury had resolved. He had done a surgery to treat his labral tear, and did a bicep release to treat his biceps tendonitis. And in September of that year, Dr. Scott saw him and said that life was good for him. He was doing well. He would release him back to work if he could have. A few weeks later, almost a month later, he was involved in a pretty serious car accident. And there was testimony that he had abrasions following the lap belt, where his lap belt was. And there was discussion from his expert, Dr. Bennett Mechanic, that in those areas there would have been, could affect his brachial plexus, and that there is some indication that this accident would have aggravated or could have aggravated the underlying condition. I believe the 6-9 instruction should have been given. And it is plaintiff's burden to apportion between those two injuries, and if they're not, the defendant's not responsible for anything that happened after that subsequent accident. If it pleases the court, I'd like to just hold the last couple of minutes for rebuttal and turn it over to Mr. Kelly.
You may. Mr. Kelly, you have 7 minutes and 30 seconds.
And I'm going to need to spend some more time on my primary argument. I have briefed the other issues, and if I run out of time, I think this one is really the important one for us all to talk about today. Justice Roy, you asked Mr. Wagner, if Mr. Webster would have purchased the policy, would he be able to sue Mr. Rimmel? And Mr. I keep forgetting your last name. Yeah?
It's Wagner.
Ben Wagner. We spent 3 weeks together. think of this. The answer was no. So that means that a tortfeasor never can be sued in tort for more than $15,000. Ever. Because if he buys the coverage, he can't sue him, and if he doesn't buy the coverage, it's a $15,000 immunity. How can that be squared with the Colorado Workers' Compensation Act and the notion of quid pro quo tort immunity? It cannot. He would be absolutely entitled to sue Mr. Grimwood for his tort damages. And I'll bet you Pinnacle would want to go along on that deal to get the money back. Of course, it's a third-party claim under workers' compensation jurisprudence. He is not within an employment relationship governed by the Act. He's not in the same employ as that word is used in the Workers' Compensation Act. To say that working Coloradans who choose to opt out lawfully no longer can sue tortious people that they work for who aren't governed by the Act, it invites the very constitutional question that we want to try to avoid in this case. I think the Snook Court is right on the constitutionality as is applied to a general contractor when a subcontractor makes that claim, because the general contractor has complied with his obligation under the Act. It has given something in return for the partial immunity it gets. We can't take that analysis and superimpose it over a situation where these lawyers are arguing that their client is always immune up to only $15,000. They're mixing no-fault remedies and tort remedies when they're not supposed to be mixed. Mr. Wagner talks about, well, they have these risks. Of course they have these risks. Mr. Grimwood had $1.5 million worth of liability insurance to assure his tort risk. He did insure that risk. Mr. Webster had a right not to be hurt tortiously. It has nothing to do with a no-fault remedy where fault has nothing to do with it at all. You can just simply fall down, break your head open, and you get coverage. It doesn't need to be anybody's fault, and that's why it's a speedy remedy. But you still can go after the additional damages. You don't get pain and suffering. You don't get the same kind of wage loss benefits. There's a huge damage enhancement going outside of the system for third-party claims where you can sue out your tort damages, pay back your coverage to your worker compensation provider. This guts that whole premise. This idea that Webster's always going, or Grimwood's always going to be immune. $15,000, in my opinion, in this day and age, that's immunity. That is not an adequate remedy. And on a constitutional level, you have to supply an adequate remedy to the injured worker in order to take away his common law rights. You may not give immunity to the tortfeasor unless he participates in the system and does something that entitles him to the immunity.
Mr. Kelly, what is your response to your opposing counsel's point that your constitutional claims were not properly preserved below?
I agree with your position, Judge Navarro.
I don't have a position. Well, I'm just asking questions.
No, sir, I didn't mean it that way. I wanted to jump up and answer your question before. I didn't have standing. My client didn't have standing to address the constitutionality until it affected him. There was a key factual issue in this case about whether or not Mr. Webster was even on the job. His position was he was asked to help Mr. Grimlow do something that was completely removed from his job. That was a factual question that the trial court determined in pretrial motions was something the jury needed to determine. We didn't know if there was even going to be a question about the application of the 4013 until after the jury verdict. There was a special interrogatory at the very end of the forms, and they said, whose version do you believe? Grimwood's, who said that Webster wanted to help unload wood from the trailer for the deck job, or Webster, who said Grimwood wanted me to help him do something unrelated? Well, they voted for the Grimwood story. So there was no standing to even address the issue until once we got the verdict, and once the court imposed the partial tort immunity. That was the point, and I did ask for briefing. It was objected to by the defense. So I don't believe I had standing until afterward.
Did you obtain a ruling from the trial court?
The trial court did not rule on it.
Did you ask the trial court? After the court had not ruled on your motion and time had elapsed, did you ever ask the court to actually issue a ruling?
I'm trying to think back as to the procedure. I think what happened, I did file a Rule 21 petition. I know a little bit awkward post-judgment, but I did file that petition with the Supreme Court. Of course, it was rejected. And I lost track of whether I went back and asked the trial judge, please rule on the constitutional issue. I don't believe that I did. I will say that for the record.
And what does that do to your preservation?
I think once I put the argument out and asked for briefing, I mean, if it's not ruled on, what am I don't understand that I have something else that I'm required to do to have my client's argument preserved.
Well, usually we review the rulings of the trial court. Here we don't have a ruling, so how do we review it?
I don't understand how I can answer that question other than to say if this cap is imposed, it puts us directly into an unconstitutional argument in this case. I've briefed it. It wasn't something that the trial court asked for briefs on. I did the best I could for my client. I told the judge I thought this was unconstitutional as it was applied to this case. Told the judge I didn't think Snook applied. I did the best I could on behalf of my client.
Okay, thank you.
I had a very novel motion that I filed to bring a big board of the statute last week, and of course it was denied. But, you know, you got to give it a shot because I'm a trial lawyer and visual aids usually work well with me. But I have a copy of the pertinent provisions of the statute. And I want to read, I think, what is the key language. It says, notwithstanding any provision of this section or section 841.402 to the contrary, any individual who is excluded from the definition of employee pursuant to section 842.022 or working general partner or sole proprietor who is not covered under a policy of workman's compensation insurance shall not have any cause of action under Articles 47, 40 through 47 of this title. What's the cause of action? For workers' compensation benefits. All right, you don't have a policy, you cannot get workers' compensation benefits. This is the Oliver Amendment. All right, goes on to say.
Mr. Kelly?
Yes, sir.
Your time has expired. Thank you very much for your arguments.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Mr. Wegener, you have a little over 2 minutes. Please remember to confine your arguments to the cross-appeal issues.
I appreciate that, and I was just going to ask, since Mr. Kelly never addressed any of my cross-appeal arguments, even if you want me to because there's nothing to rebut, I guess.
Exactly.
So I don't know if I need to say anything else. So if you guys, I could talk a little bit more about it.
Looks like we don't have any questions, so you could sit down.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much, both of you, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and the written opinion will issue in due course. Thanks. That bailiff may announce a recess.